depending on where you are in the world. And welcome to Information Week Live for the week of November 1st, 2015. The first of our Information Week Live episodes of the fall to be conducted in standard time rather than daylight savings time. So as the shadows fall across the swamp, we're glad to have you with us today. This should be a great episode. I'm your host, Kurt Franklin, the executive editor for technical content at Information Week. And joining me around the table are two of my longtime partners in crime. We have from Dark Reading, Sarah Peters, who is senior editor over there. Sarah, welcome to Information Week Live.
Thank you for having me, Kurt. It's a pleasure.
It's always a pleasure to have you here. And, of course, we have with us my fellow executive editor at Information Week, executive editor for Community, Dave Wagner. Dave, welcome to Information Week Live.
Thanks, Kurt. When you said that, it reminded me, I think we're 3 weeks away from our five-year anniversary of working together. So I'll have to get you some sort of present. I don't know what the five-year anniversary is. Maybe wood.
We'll see. We started
digital
working
wood
together in the middle of November 5 years ago.
Yes.
Wow.
It seems a very long time ago. A great deal has happened. Maybe sometime between now and the end of the year, we'll have to put together some sort of look back show at what has happened in the tech industry since we all started working together.
Sounds fun.
Very, very, very arrogant of us, and also I would love to do it.
Very arrogant and entirely in character. Well, let's get started today. Dave, I'm going to turn to you. It's been, in some ways, a quiet week in the industry. We haven't had these giant things going on, but there have been a couple of fairly significant things going on. So what do you think qualifies as the big story for the past week?
Well, I think the biggest story probably has to do with a major divorce and a breakup. And, of course, I'm speaking of Gwen Stefani and Blake Shelton of in The Voice. No, of course I'm talking about Hewlett-Packard, now, of course, becoming Hewlett and Packard. and what that means for the larger tech industry, and really what it means for you know, enterprise IT. There are an awful lot of HP customers out there, both from a product point of view and a consulting point of view, and you know, that's a big change. And you know, it's one of those Silicon Valley giants that have been around a long time going through a major change. It's almost a little nostalgic. We even have a slideshow up right now on the sort of timeline of Hewlett-Packard, and it's sort of amazing how long they've been together. And of course, it's still going to be two, hopefully, as Meg Whitman says, agile and fascinating companies. We'll see what actually happens, but that, I think, is the biggest story.
Well, you know, I agree that that's a huge story, and of course, it's a story that we knew was coming for a year, basically. The split became final this week, and to me, it's interesting to look at what HP says they're trying to do. As you say, each company being more focused and more agile, and to compare that with what Dell is doing, and that seems to be they're doing their darndest to become the IBM of 1986. you know, these are two companies where the executives are obviously looking at the same technology marketplace and reaching two entirely different conclusions about how to best compete. And I think it's going to be fascinating to watch and see if one is right or if both of them are right, if the two companies are so different that each one can be very successful with their model. Do you have any feeling for how you think that's going to go?
I actually think that both groups have made the right conclusion for themselves. I think for whatever reason, every time HP has recently, in the last, say, 10 years, has tried to make itself larger, has tried to acquire something like when they acquired Palm or when they acquired Compaq or any of this, anytime they've tried to bring something in, they seem to have not been able to assimilate. And it is perhaps best for that group of leaders, those people who are there, to say, let's focus. Let's figure out what we're good at and do it without messing things up. And so they can be two companies that do what they do. I have to say, while Dell hasn't made acquisitions that have gone through the roof, they really haven't sort of blundered acquisitions either. Mostly they've been able to acquire these things, add the revenue, add the talent, and keep those companies rolling with a reasonable, you know, facsimile of what they were before. I'm sure there are some I'm missing. There are always exceptions to both rules on both sides. But it feels like Dell has, for whatever reason, the talent within its leadership to acquire and grow in a way that doesn't hurt itself, that HP currently does not have within its walls.
You know, I think that's interesting, and I will say that I think that some of that goes back to something that Michael Dell was able to do two decades ago at least, when he recognized that the company had reached a size that was such that he wasn't really qualified to be. And he stayed as chairman, but he hired a CEO. And so that notion of bringing in new talent and bringing in people who were likely to have an impact on the culture seems to have started pretty early. And I think that one of the great things that Dell has done in many of their acquisitions, again, not all, is to take a relatively hands-off approach to the and the culture of the company. They don't try to make every company they acquire become part of the Dellplex. And I think that has been a very powerful tool in helping all of these things to work together.
Right. Well, there's an M and an A in M and A, right? And it seems like, for the most part, HP was concentrating on the M, and Dell has been concentrating on the A, and maybe that's the difference.
Yeah, I'm curious. You guys know more about this than I do. I don't follow the business end of things as much. But with HP, the split that they're making, they have an enterprise company now, and then they've got this separate entity which is just making the PCs and the printers and other hardware. Am I understanding that correctly?
That's essentially correct, yes.
That's essentially it. So what I find interesting about that in comparison to, say, what Dell has done over the years is that it was not that long ago where Dell decided, hey, we're not going to worry about the consumer business anymore. We're not going to focus on that. We're really just an enterprise thing, and all of their acquisitions and all of their moves since then have made it very clear that is their focus, that's their aim. They made a decision and they have actively followed it. And it's interesting to me that HP is holding on, has decided to make a separate company to continue to have some kind of a PC business that they are still devoted to. They're just not making it this tiny little afterthought. They're making it a separate thing, so it's not necessarily the little the little runt of the litter kind of thing that gets neglected, is what I'm hoping. Because as you know, I've been waiting for I ordered a power cord from Dell like 3 weeks ago, and I still haven't gotten it because their customer service really doesn't care about getting it to me, because they're not a consumer company anymore. They're an enterprise company, and that is where they're that's what they're aiming to be. If HP is still interested in being a consumer company to some degree, I think it's an interesting dichotomy.
I think that for purposes of best user support and customer service, all of us need to change our last name to LLC. I think that would probably have a positive effect. And, you know, as we've been talking about this, I was thinking about another acquisition that actually occurred at the very end of last week, but we didn't have a chance to talk about it. And that is IBM's latest acquisition, where they bought the Weather Company. Now, they did not buy the Weather Channel. The Weather Channel will continue as it is, but they bought all of the data gathering and analysis functions that sit behind the Weather Channel. Is there any way to make sense of that in terms of all this, the other business moves that we've been talking about with Dell and with HP?
What's fascinating about that, of course, is that Dell and HP, as you mentioned earlier, are where IBM was a while ago, right? They still make things, right? IBM, for the most part, with some exceptions, has divested itself of its PC line, most of its servers and other hardware lines, and have been an interesting hybrid of that's not just merely a consulting firm, but in many ways has been a consulting firm for a while, and now, most importantly, it's a data company. IBM sells data. That's what it does now. It sells machine learning and data, and it's not Big Blue anymore. It's Big Data, and that's great, I think. There's nothing wrong with that, because for decades, what has always separated IBM wasn't its hardware, although it made some really great business machines for a long time. It was its patents. It was its research. It was its knowledge and intelligence. And they have found a way in a post-iPhone world to sell the thing they're good at, rather than trying to hang on because of the great markup there is in printer ink, you know, the way HP is kind of doing. I think it's a brilliant move. My only concern, if I were an IBM senior leader, is selling data by itself a differentiator anymore when companies like GE are selling just as good data knowledge and also have the experience still of making something? If I were IBM, I would consider having my hands in a few more physical things in the world, because I think Jeff Immelt, you know, he said what makes GE special is that it takes 25 years to figure out how to build the things they build. But they also know how to give you the data. I don't know what IBM sells that somebody else can't sell if they can convince you they're just as smart.
I agree with you entirely on everything you just said, Dave. I think it's a genius move on IBM's part, because instead, while everybody else is out there buying services, you know, new services to offer, they're realizing that data is exceptionally valuable. And I say data, not content, because as media people, we know that it's hard to sell content in certain ways. But data, and particularly that kind of data, can be extremely valuable. And I think IBM recognizes that. They know that. And they're on top of it. But I also agree that they could potentially be a major player in the Internet of Things business. They already are. But I do think that somebody with a manufacturing pedigree like a GE is going to be ahead of them in that. But I don't think that means that there's not going to be plenty of room for other people to play in that pool. And this is a, you know, this move by IBM is very intriguing to me, and I think that they're probably onto something that other people are going to. Some people are teasing them about it now, but I suspect that there are going to be others following their lead in the not too distant future.
Right. You know, we call it data as a service or analytics as a service, but really what I think it is sense making as a service. Like, you're right, it's not about content of data. It's not about the storage. Like, with all due respect to Microsoft's Azure cloud, and that's a big data play too, right? But it's a different kind of data play. That is saying, you know, we will store your data, we'll help you make sense of your data, but you're going to do the thinking, right? IBM is actually selling the sense-making, the thought-making, the business analytics, the intelligence. They're selling intelligence as a service is what they're doing. And as long as people think they're the most intelligent people on the block, that's awesome because that's what people are worried about the most right now, is they feel like they're awash in data and they don't have any sense of it. So yeah, as long as people see Watson and the other products in that analytics and intelligence space as the smartest guy on the block, it makes total sense.
Well, you know, we've been talking about data, about analysis, about manufacturing, big and small, all that. But in all of this, there are all kinds of angles that have to be considered. And Sarah, since you're here, I wanted to ask, you know, do you see either security as a component of any of these, or was there a big security story this week that Dave and I might have missed in the glare coming off the HP dissolution?
Well, I mean, there's always security news. I would say that probably, well, two things. I want to tell you about a little kind of what I would say a fun bit of malware that I saw this week, and then just a thought that came up in a conversation I had that I'd like your thoughts on. But first I'll tell you about this amusing malware. Not sure how familiar you are with CryptoWall. It's a kind of ransomware. Ransomware is the stuff that comes onto your machine, it encrypts everything and says, hey, give me all your money and then I'll give you your stuff back. Usually it doesn't want all your money. It's usually about a ransom of about $300 payable in Bitcoin, and then it gives you the decryption key. CryptoWall has been around for a while. The CryptoWall 3.0 came out in January and has so far extorted about $325 million from about tens of thousands of victims. And this week now they've seen CryptoWall 4.0. And what I find really entertaining about it is that its ransom message has taken a really different tack on it. Now, instead of the usual play of being very threatening, it kind of says it has this sort of creepy welcome wagon thing. Like it says, I'll read you some of it. It puts up this big message that says, congratulations, you have become a part of the large community crypto wall. and then it encrypts all of your stuff, and it says, The instructions that you find in folders with encrypted files are not viruses. They are your helpers. And it gives, and then it has these thinly veiled folks about don't go to the security companies because you should think logically. And all that they'll do is prove fatal to your files. And they leave you with this little thread at the bottom, which is, in case these simple rules are violated, we will not be able to help you, and we will not try because you have been warned. And then, as I know, it's great, right? And then they, instead of saying, you know, pay up and pay us this ransom, it says to get the to have things decrypted, you pay $700. So it's twice as much as it usually is to purchase a software package. That's the way. So they're branding it like it's a, like they're offering a security service to you.
They should send you a poster and a membership card.
Exactly. Exactly. It sounds like you've just moved into a very creepy gated community. Is how it feels with this particular method. So I found it kind of terrible and also kind of hilarious at the same time. And I thought
I like the gated community visual, but I'm also hearing, a stereotypical person out of an old, an Edward G. Robinson film, who's going into the store owner and saying, this is a lovely bit of data you have here. It would be such a shame should an accident befall it.
So is this targeting mostly enterprises or consumers?
No, mostly with ransomware. Generally, doesn't ransomware kind of goes after everybody?
Well, I understand that. Mostly, but is an enterprise more capable of stopping this? Like, is this hitting vulnerable computers mostly?
Ransomware has taken over. It mostly goes after. Let's put it this way. It's mostly goes after. It's pretty indiscriminate about who it goes after, but it's not always easy to know when it's first crept onto your machine. And they go after kind of lowest common denominator because they assume that you don't really have anybody who's going to try to find out how to fix it. You'll just pay them and move on with your life, which is why, $300 is a lot for some people, but it's not enough to, it's cheaper than it would be to buy a whole new computer. And CryptoWall is one of the more serious ones because it is crypto ransomware. There are some other kinds of ransomware out there that will say it's encrypted everything, but it hasn't really. Or there's things that they have the ability to destroy your files, but they don't really. They're sketchy. But there have been police departments that have had their machines encrypted. And some of the more sophisticated stuff, actually, they'll encrypt all of your files and then destroy your backups. And in those cases, some police departments have said, hey, FBI guys, would you help us out here, try to fix this so that we don't have to pay a ransom? And the FBI says, actually, we can't fix this for you. And police departments have paid ransoms to
Wow.
cyber criminals in order to retrieve their assets.
Wow.
So when I say it's indiscriminate,
yeah.
It's indiscriminate. And
right.
I can't tell you how many enterprises it goes after because, and this kind of brings me to the next thing I wanted to ask you guys about, because it is not something that anybody needs to disclose because it does not fall into the data theft category. There's no customer, there's no personally identifiable information that's being lost in this way. Even if it's encrypted and destroyed, or, you know, it's not being exposed, right? So there's not a breach in the same way that there would be a breach in some other definition of the term. It's really just we paid it and we moved and we got our stuff back, and now nobody needs to be the wiser of it. There's probably lots of ransoms being paid and the public doesn't know about it. And
right.
And that's probably what I was conversation with someone just yesterday, saying that there are, particularly with mobile applications, that a lot of the threats are, a lot of the criminals go after mobile devices, are not necessarily interested in stealing personally identifiable information yet, but there is a lot of money to be lost there, because a lot of the apps are just big money makers. A lot of the purchases that are made, like in gaming and things like that, will make millions and millions of dollars. And so the revenue that's possibly lost is huge. And also, but that doesn't need to be disclosed by any, there's no laws saying you have to disclose when you've been attacked and lost $2 million today. And there's no law when it says you've been attacked and you lost a whole bunch of intellectual property. There's no law that says you have to tell the media when that happened. So there's just a whole lot of attacks that we don't know about.
Right. Well, I guess I get that to a certain degree.
Yeah.
Because if you haven't lost it, you haven't lost it. Although I question whether the next step is to actually move the data onto your own evil server and then ransom it. If I get it back at that point, do I have to report it? That seems like a whole different deal than just locking the data down and making it inaccessible for a while.
Say that one more time, because I'm not sure if I understood what you meant.
So let's say I built, instead of building something that attacks somebody's computer, locks their data down, but with encryption. Instead, mm-hmm. let's say I build something that actually steals the data, puts it in my own server, and I say I'll give it back if you pay. Is that covered under existing laws then, because I've lost the data at least temporarily?
Yeah, I would imagine it would be.
And then what does an enterprise do, or anybody, but I'm assuming it's an enterprise that really cares. Once they are infected with this and they pay the ransom, what's preventing this from happening again next week?
There's nothing.
Yeah.
There's absolutely nothing.
This is my biggest fear.
But what's interesting is that there is a real, a fascinating economy in cybercrime. And it seems like, for the most part, they keep pretty good records of who they've hit and who they haven't. And they've already chosen what are good price points. So they know, okay, 300 is a price that most people will pay, and 500 isn't. And then they might experiment. Like, there's a new version of CryptoWall that's asking a lot of money. It might work because they've changed some of their it does work, then that means that CryptoWall 4.0 can bring in a ransom of $700, whereas CryptoWall 3.0 could not. If that's the case, then that means that the attackers find out, you know what, there's not a lot of people paying this $700 ransom. We're going to bring it back down to, you know, 500. They're going to play with it. They really have excellent economists in the ransomware community, because they know that if they just keep hitting the same target over and over again, the chances of them paying up will become fewer. Those, you know, chances of an easy payout will just keep going down, down, down.
Yeah,
it's interesting that you mentioned the economist, because as you were talking about that, I was imagining the Freakonomics guys using this as an example of how price elasticity works.
There you go.
Well, this is, you know, Sarah, you have once again done what you do so well and caused all of us to be terribly uneasy about the state of our data and our systems, and we appreciate that. But I'm afraid that we're getting close to the end of our show here, and we haven't had a chance to discuss the Geek End yet. Dave, what's happening in the Geek End this week?
Yeah, this is I think a fun week. NBC Universal and Viacom, which as probably most people here know, are two of the major players in television. They own many of the most popular cable channels, have joined Time Warner, who owns practically the rest of those cable channels, in getting into the mind reading game. And this is a lot of fun. They've opened up mind reading labs, one in New York and one in Orlando, and they are using what's actually more accurately called neuromarketing or consumer neuroscience to start reading our minds as we watch television, particularly television commercials, and the scenes in television shows right before the planned commercial. And the idea is they use biometrics and EEG, sometimes functional MRI, skin responses, eye movement, infrared, a lot of things to watch you watch TV in a controlled setting. And they see what parts of your body and your brain are triggered by watching the show. And the idea behind this is that, say, watching a scene on a cooking show or somebody eating food during a scene on a drama or whatever triggers the hunger center in your brain, they'll be able to sell the commercial right after that scene at a premium price to some sort of snack company.
This makes me ill.
It does. Now, here's the bright side. This has been going on since the 90s in one way or another. The idea came from Harvard, as usual, in the 90s. When I heard about this, my first thought was, geez, that sounds awful. My second thought was, but does it work? And the truth of the matter is, right now, it doesn't. There was a study done by Temple University, backed up by NYU, that basically came to the conclusion they tested 8 different types of neuromarketing, and they discovered that only one of those did better than a traditional survey. Most of them were completely debunked. Some of them were, we need more information to make them work. Now, the fun part about the functional MRI one is, yes, functional MRI does work better than a traditional survey. In fact, we have a fun study that shows that functional MRI can be used to pick whether a song is going to make the top 40 better than asking a teen whether they like the song or not. Sometimes they don't even know they like the song, but their brain will tell them that they do. So we know that it'll work, but the problem is it's really actually hard to do. There are very few people who can use a functional MRI to get scientifically useful results, including scientists. And the way we know this is a couple of years ago at Dartmouth, a person completely as satire showed pictures of humans in different emotional states to a salmon, a fish, hooked up to a functional MRI, and wait for it, the salmon was dead. So they showed pictures to a dead fish. they took the functional MRI results from the dead fish. I can't stress enough that this was a not live fish. They took the results from the functional MRI. They put it under standard statistical measurements that science has used with functional MRI and showed statistical significance to whether the fish could determine human emotion. So what this actually did, of course, because it was a dead salmon, is that it showed that there are lots of false positives with functional MRI and that it's very hard to make sure that you use it correctly. So not anytime soon do I expect NBC Universal to be able to sell advertising based on functional MRI. But the truth is, we know this is possible. This is a database of knowledge that we're building. And one day or another, we're going to be able to do this.
And it's a good time for me to mention that there are some key security vulnerabilities in EEG and MRI, neuro, all of these machines that you've been mentioning.
Oh, lovely.
I'm working on a sort of a longer term piece about it. There, apparently, the precise machines you're talking about, it's not that there's anything particularly bad that's specific to, that's really specific to them. It's that they just don't do the basic security that they ought to do. Like they don't use the fundamental security 101 kind of communications that they should. And that was the case with all of the EEG machines that this particular researcher studied. So that's something to think about. That I think would further complicate the use of advertising and marketing companies to decide what it is that they can do next to make us do their bidding.
Right. Then,
so
and,
I think
and,
really.
It makes me want to rig the machine so it tells them that my product lights up the brain better than any other one, and that means you should give me a really great advertising rate or whatever.
Yeah.
Well, I just know that the next time that I get queried to do a Nielsen diary, I think I'm going to let a small rotting halibut fill it out for me, because obviously that will be just as accurate.
It's funny that you say that, because Nielsen is one of the biggest users of neuro marketing in the world. They have a whole neuroscience department that claims they will help you make more successful television, radio, and music.
I think much of today's television probably has been influenced by the opinions of a dead salmon. So that really does make sense. It makes perfect sense.
So I know we're running low on time, but I need to tell one fun story about this, where there's a success around this. In 2011... somebody used functional MRI to investigate for Frito-Lay why people liked Cheetos so much. And they discovered that the thing they liked the most about Cheetos is the yellow dust and gunky stuff that gets on your hands after you eat it. They don't actually like
really?
The taste. Yeah, they don't actually like the taste any more than any other snack. But it lights up the part of their brain that we have subversive glee around. You know, we feel like we're breaking a rule. We're an adult who's getting messy. So they figured this out, and so they did a series of commercials that were around, and probably people remember these, a series of commercials, there were 13 of them, around doing subversive things with Cheetos. Like there's one where somebody has fallen asleep on an airplane and somebody is shoving Cheetos up their nose.
Yes.
And
yes.
Then there are others.
They're great.
They're great. And there are others where people have, you know, made the yellow dust explode and cover people entirely and things like that. Those commercials, I think in 2013, won the Ogilvy Prize for the best commercials of the year. They absolutely did increase sales for Frito-Lay, and they were based entirely on functional MRI results. The problem is we can't seem to replicate this, but it's real and it's hilarious when done well. What Cheetos did, I think, isn't really creepy. It's a little creepy, but really saying, why is our product successful? What do you like about it? And then making commercials we all enjoyed watching isn't all that creepy in the end. You know, it's kind of fun.
That's how they get you.
Yes. It's like any other tool, right? It's who's using it and how.
Yes, they're coming for us one rotting fish brain at a time. I think that's as it should be. As always, I hope that everyone will leave listening to this episode and rush right over and read Dave's Geekend. Always thought-provoking, always something interesting to take with you as you head off for the end of the work week and the beginning of 2 days of what we like to call real life. Well, I'm afraid that we've come to the end of that little haven of real life that is Information Week Live. I'd like to thank my fellow panelists here on today's episode. First, Sarah Peters, thanks so much for taking time out of your schedule to be with us and once again make us profoundly depressed about the state of IT security.
Hey, Kurt, it's my job, and it was a pleasure. Thank you.
Well, speaking of your job, I know you've got a lot coming up over at Dark Reading. Can you give us a hint about what you might be covering in the next week and tell folks how to follow you on social media to keep up with what's going on over there?
You can find me on Twitter at Sarah Peters. There's no H in Sarah. Go on darkreading.com and you'll see what's coming next. I can't tell you what's coming Monday because it is on embargo and I am strictly forbidden to give you any hints whatsoever. But that will be coming Monday morning. There's another thing I'm thinking about all of the stories I've got lined up for next week, all of which are strictly on embargo right now. So I'm afraid I can't tell you anything about what I'm doing next week. But it's going to be good. And it's going to be scary.
If it's good and scary, then we know we have to check it out. So everyone, be sure to follow Sarah's Twitter handle and check often over at Dark Reading. It's the next best thing to waiting for the midnight release of the newest Stephen King novel. Well, Dave, I hope that the stuff that you are working on is a little bit less horrifying than what Sarah typically brings us.
I actually don't know, because this week I'm going to work on an article about worst commutes from various cities. We've really had a lot of positive feedback about talking about work-life balance, and so one of the things I'm going to do is a slideshow on the tech centers with the worst and the best commute times and some other lifestyle issues. So if you hate traffic, you might hate me more than Sarah this week. But I'm going to work hard. I'm going to work hard because I need to save money so I can buy my data back when I'm caught in a ransom. And if I have any left over, I'm going to buy Sarah an H.
Hey, I don't need it. Get me a power cord for my Dell.
Well, in the meantime, Dave, how can people follow you on Twitter and the other social media to find out when you're able to tell us where we all should be moving if we want really good commutes?
At GeekendDave on Twitter, and you can find me at Information Week and allanalytics.com.
Well, thanks for being with us. As for me, I'm going to be actually away. I'm going to be on assignment Monday and Tuesday of next week. I'm going to be visiting with the folks at SAP and their Jam Communities group. So I'll be reporting from there. And then later on in the week, well, who knows what we're going to be doing. I've got a number of conversations set up with folks, specifically how different educational institutions are using technology. You know, we often find some very interesting uses over in academia. That's what I'm hoping to bring you. You can follow me and find out when I do that on Twitter at KG4GWA. And if you like videos that are a little bit lighthearted, follow me on Periscope. Same handle as Twitter, KG4GWA. Well, we also thank, of course, you for being here with us. We would not and could not do this every week without you, our listener. If you're listening to this in an on-demand format, first of all, thank you very much. We appreciate it. But remember that we are live every Friday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. We'd love to have you with us, love to have your voice in the online conversation that goes on right alongside the radio program. Well, for Sarah Peters, Dave Wagner, and all of us here at Information Week Live, I'm Kurt Franklin. Thanks so much for being with us. We'll see you next week.